Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Frantz Fanon, revolutionary journalist. Those who have studied the global black revolution of the 20th century have had to read the masterwork of Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, which was known as the handbook of the black revolution from Accra in Ghana to Oakland in California. This work, as much a psychological study as a diagnosis of the nature of French colonialism in Algeria, gave militants tremendous insights into the nature of imperialism and how resistance exploded against it. Former Black Panther leader Kathleen Neal Cleaver has written that Fanon's influence on black revolutionaries in the U.S. was profound. But before he published The Wretched of the Earth, he wrote a remarkable series of articles anonymously for the Algerian revolutionary journal El Mujahid from September 1957 to January 1960. El Mujahid's attacks on the French political and military colonial officials is unusually sharp and focused, reflecting Fanon's unique psychological and ideological insights into the Algerian and African struggles against imperialism. El Mujahid is an Arabic term meaning one who wages jihad or struggle, and here one sees Fanon in a potent war of words against the foreign occupation of Algeria. But Fanon was far more than a word warrior. In his 1964 work, Toward the African Revolution, we find Fanon, the critic, the political analyst, the Africanist, the internationalist, the Marxist, and the anti-imperialist. In his El Mujahid articles, Fanon anonymously gives voice to the FLN, French, Front Libération Nationale, English, National Liberation Front, and ridicules French efforts to tie the FLN to raids, killings, and massacres, condemns Arab and African collaborators, and dissects how French forces use torture to intimidate the Algerian resistance. Fanon writes, "Torture in Algeria is not an accident or an error or a fault. Colonialism cannot be understood without the possibility of torturing, of violating, or of massacring." Fanon was a revolutionary journalist, or perhaps more clearly, a revolutionary who also worked as a journalist. His heart was with all anti-imperialist, revolutionary, and national liberation movements. His heart was with rebel friends like Nkrumah of Ghana and Lumumba of Congo. His heart was with what he called the wretched of the earth, the world's dispossessed. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, September 15th, 2017. So I have been told we are finally back for our book club, Wisdom Teeth Extractions on consecutive weeks, back pain, all kinds of ailments derailed the book club just enormously over the past month. But we are back. Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. So we're picking up where we left off. I think it's been 2 weeks since our most recent broadcast. I think people were asking for the third study session before. That was not in the archives. I was greatly delayed in getting that uploaded because of major health issues, but I am healed and almost 100%, and the third episode has already been uploaded. So if you check iTunes, you should see it. It'll be posted like all the episodes normally are. Frantz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, Part 3. You should see it up for, I think it's August 11th, the exact date, if you need help. Without further delay, we will go ahead and get started. Again, context of white supremacy. This is Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. We are a little bit beyond, or right at about the halfway point. Context of white supremacy, this is audio segment number 1.
The theoretical question that for the last 50 years has been raised whenever the history of underdeveloped countries is under discussion, whether or not the bourgeois phase can be skipped, ought to be answered in the field of revolutionary action and not by logic. The bourgeois phase in undeveloped countries can only justify itself insofar as the national bourgeoisie has sufficient economic and technical strength to build up a bourgeois society, to create the conditions necessary for the development of a large-scale proletariat, to mechanize agriculture, and finally to make possible the existence of an authentic national culture. A bourgeoisie similar to that which developed in Europe is able to elaborate an ideology and at the same time strengthen its own power. Such a bourgeoisie, dynamic, educated, and secular, has fully succeeded in its undertaking of the accumulation of capital and has given to the nation a minimum of prosperity. In underdeveloped countries, we have seen that no true bourgeoisie exists. There is only a sort of little greedy caste, avid and voracious, with the mind of a huckster, only too glad to accept the dividends that the former colonial power hands out to it. This get-rich-quick middle class shows itself incapable of great ideas or of inventiveness. It remembers what it has read in European textbooks, and imperceptibly it becomes not even a replica of Europe, but its caricature. The struggle against the bourgeoisie of underdeveloped countries is far from being a theoretical one. It is not concerned with making out its condemnation as laid down by the judgment of history. The national bourgeoisie of underdeveloped countries must not be opposed because it threatens to slow down the total, harmonious development of the nation. It must simply be stoutly opposed because literally, it is good for nothing. This bourgeoisie, expressing its mediocrity in its profits, its achievements, and in its thought, tries to hide this mediocrity by buildings which have prestige value at the individual level, by chromium plating on big American cars, by holidays on the Riviera and weekends on neon-lit nightclubs. This bourgeoisie, which turns its back more and more on the people as a whole, does not even succeed in extracting spectacular concessions from the West, such as investments which would be of value for the country's economy or the setting up of certain industries. On the contrary, assembly plants spring up and consecrate the type of neo-colonialist industrialization in which the country's economy flounders. Thus, it must not be said that the national bourgeoisie retards the country's evolution, that it makes it lose time, or that it threatens to lead the nation up blind alleys. In fact, the bourgeois phase in the history of underdeveloped countries is a completely useless phase. When this caste has vanished, devoured by its own contradictions, it will be seen that nothing new has happened since independence was proclaimed, and that everything must be started again from scratch. The changeover will not take place at the level of the structure set up by the bourgeoisie during its reign, since that caste has done nothing more than take over unchanged the legacy of the economy, the thought, and the institutions left by the colonialists. It is all the easier to neutralize this bourgeois class in that, as we have seen, it is numerically, intellectually, and economically weak. In the colonized territories, the bourgeois caste draws its strength after independence chiefly from agreements reached with the former colonial power. The national bourgeoisie has all the more opportunity to take over from the oppressor since it has been given time for a leisurely tete-a-tete with the ex-colonial power. But deep-rooted contradictions undermine the ranks of that bourgeoisie. It is this that gives the observer an impression of instability. There is not, as yet, a homogeneity of caste. Many intellectuals, for example, condemn this regime based on the domination of the few. In underdeveloped countries, there are certain members of the elite, intellectuals and civil servants, who are sincere, who feel the necessity for a planned economy. The outlawing of profiteers and the strict prohibition of attempts at mystification. In addition, such men fight in certain measure for the mass participation of the people in the ordering of public affairs. In those underdeveloped countries which accede to independence, there almost always exist a small number of honest intellectuals who have no very precise ideas about politics, but who instinctively distrust the race for positions and pensions, which is symptomatic of the early days of independence in colonized countries. The personal situation of these men, breadwinners of large families, or their background, hard struggles and a strictly moral upbringing, explains their manifest contempt for profiteers and schemers. We must now know how to use these men in the decisive battle that we mean to engage upon, which will lead to a healthier outlook for the nation. Closing the road to the national bourgeoisie is certainly the means whereby the vicissitudes of newfound independence may be avoided, and with them the decline of morals, the installing of corruption within the country, economic regression, and the immediate disaster of an anti-democratic regime depending on force and intimidation. But it is also the only means toward progress. What holds up the taking of a decision by the profoundly democratic elements of the young nation and adds to their timidity is the apparent strength of the bourgeoisie. In newly independent, underdeveloped countries, the whole of the ruling class swarms into the towns built by colonialism. The absence of any analysis of the total population induces onlookers to think that there exists a powerful and perfectly organized bourgeoisie. In fact, we know today that the bourgeoisie in underdeveloped countries is non-existent. What creates a bourgeoisie is not the bourgeois spirit, nor its taste or manners, nor even its aspirations. The bourgeoisie is above all the direct product of precise economic conditions. Now, in the colonies, the economic conditions are conditions of a foreign bourgeoisie. Through its agents, it is the bourgeoisie of the mother country that we find present in the colonial towns. The bourgeoisie in the colonies is, before independence, a Western bourgeoisie, a true branch of the bourgeoisie of the mother country, that derives its legitimacy, its force, and its stability from the bourgeoisie of the homeland. During the period of unrest that precedes independence, certain native elements, intellectuals and traders who live in the midst of that imported bourgeoisie, try to identify themselves with it. A permanent wish for identification with the bourgeoisie, representatives of the mother country, is to be found among the native intellectuals and merchants. This native bourgeoisie, which has adopted unreservedly and with enthusiasm the ways of thinking characteristic of the mother country, which has become wonderfully detached from its own thought and has based its consciousness upon foundations which are typically foreign, will realize with its mouth watering that it lacks something essential to a bourgeoisie: money. The bourgeoisie of an underdeveloped country is a bourgeoisie in spirit only. It is not its economic strength, nor the dynamism of its leaders, nor the breadth of its ideas that ensures its peculiar quality as bourgeoisie. Consequently, it remains at the beginning and for a long time afterward a bourgeoisie of the civil service. It is the positions that it holds in the new national administration which will give it strength and serenity. If the government gives it enough time and opportunity, this bourgeoisie will manage to put away enough money to stiffen its domination. But it will always reveal itself as incapable of giving birth to an authentic bourgeois society with all the economic and industrial consequences which this entails. From the beginning, the national bourgeoisie directs its efforts toward activities of the intermediary type. The basis of its strength is found in its aptitude for trade and small business enterprises and in securing commissions. It is not its money that works, but its business acumen. It does not go in for investments, and it cannot achieve that accumulation of capital necessary to the birth and blossoming of an authentic bourgeoisie. At that rate, it would take centuries to set on foot an embryonic industrial revolution, and in any case, it would find the way barred by the relentless opposition of the former mother country, which will have taken all precautions when setting up neo-colonialist trade conventions. If the government wants to bring the country out of its stagnation and set it well on the road toward development and progress, it must first and foremost nationalize the middleman's trading center. The bourgeoisie, who wish to see both the triumph of the spirit of money-making and the enjoyment of consumer goods, and at the same time the triumph of their contemptuous attitude toward the mass of the people and the scandalous aspect of profit-making, should not we rather call it robbery? In fact, invest largely in this sector. The intermediary market, which formerly was dominated by the settlers, will be invaded by the young national bourgeoisie. In a colonial economy, the intermediary sector is by far the most important. If you want to progress, you must decide in the first few hours to nationalize this sector. But it is clear that such a nationalization ought not to take on a rigidly state-controlled aspect. It is not a question of placing at the head of these services citizens who've had no political education. Every time such a procedure has been adopted, it has been seen that the government has in fact contributed to the triumph of a dictatorship of civil servants who had been set in the mold of the former mother country and who quickly showed themselves incapable of thinking in terms of the nation as a whole. These civil servants, very soon began to sabotage the national economy and to throw its structure out of joint. Under them, corruption, prevarication, the diversion of stocks, and the black market came to stay. Nationalizing the intermediary sector means organizing wholesale and retail cooperatives on a democratic basis. It also means decentralizing these cooperatives by getting the mass of the people interested in the ordering of public affairs. You will not be able to do all this unless you give the people some political education. Previously, it was realized that this key problem should be clarified once and for all. Today, it is true that the principle of the political education of the masses is generally subscribed to in underdeveloped countries, but it does not seem that this primordial task is really taken to heart. When people stress the need to educate the people politically, they decide to point out at the same time that they want to be supported by the people in the action that they are taking. A government which declares that it wishes to educate the people politically thus expresses its desire to govern with the people and for the people. It ought not to speak a language destined to camouflage a bourgeois administration. In the capitalist countries, the bourgeois governments have long left this infantile stage of authority behind. To put it bluntly, they govern with the help of their laws, their economic strength, and their police. Now that their power is firmly established, they no longer need to lose time in striking demagogic attitudes. They govern in their own interest, and they have the courage of their own strength. They have created legitimacy, and they are strong in their own right. The bourgeois caste in newly independent countries has not yet the cynicism nor the unruffled calm which is founded on the strength of long-established bourgeoisies. From this springs the fact that it shows a certain anxiety to hide its real convictions, to sidetrack, and in short, to set itself up as a popular force. But the inclusion of the masses in politics does not consist in mobilizing 3 or 4 times a year 10,000 or 100,000 men and women. These mass meetings and spectacular gatherings are akin to the old tactics that date from before independence, whereby you exhibited your forces in order to prove to yourself and to others that you had the people behind you. The political education of the masses proposes not to treat the masses as children, but to make adults of them. This brings us to consider the role of the political party in an underdeveloped country. We have seen in the preceding pages that very often simple souls, who moreover belong to the newly born bourgeoisie, never stop repeating that in an underdeveloped country the direction of affairs by a strong authority, in other words, a dictatorship, is a necessity. With this in view, the party is given the task of supervising the masses. The party plays understudy to the administration and the police and controls the masses, not in order to make sure that they really participate in the business of governing the nation, but in order to remind them constantly that the government expects from them obedience and discipline. That famous dictatorship, whose supporters believe that it is called for by the historical process and consider it an indispensable prelude to the dawn of independence, in fact symbolizes the decision of the bourgeois caste to govern the underdeveloped country first with the help of the people, but soon against them. The progressive transformation of the party into an information service is the indication that the government holds itself more and more on the defensive. The incoherent mass of the people is seen as a blind force that must be continually held in check, either by mystification or by the fear inspired by the police force. The party acts as a barometer and as an information service. The militant is turned into an informer. He is entrusted with punitive expeditions against the villages. The embryo opposition parties are liquidated by beatings and stonings. The opposition candidates see their houses set on fire. The police increase their provocations. In these conditions, you may be sure the party is unchallenged and 99.99% of the votes are cast for the government candidate. We should add that in Africa, a certain number of governments actually behave in this way. All the opposition parties, which moreover are usually progressive and would therefore tend to work for the greater influence of the masses in the conduct of public matters, and who desire that the proud, money-making bourgeoisie should be brought to heel, have been by dint of baton charges and prisons condemned first to silence and then to a clandestine existence. The political party in many parts of Africa which are today independent is puffed up in a most dangerous way. In the presence of a member of the party, the people are silent, behave like a flock of sheep, and publish panegyrics in praise of the government or the leader. But in the street, when evening comes, away from the village, in the cafes or by the river, the bitter disappointment of the people, their despair, but also their unceasing anger, makes itself heard. The party, instead of welcoming the expression of popular discontent, instead of taking for its fundamental purpose the free flow of ideas from the people up to the government, forms a screen and forbids such ideas. The party leaders behave like common sergeant majors, frequently reminding the people of the need for silence in the ranks. This party, which used to call itself the servant of the people, which used to claim that it worked for the full expression of the people's will, as soon as the colonial power puts the country into its control, hastens to send the people back to their caves. As far as national unity is concerned, the party will also make many mistakes, as for example, when the so-called national party behaves as a party based on ethnic differences. It becomes, in fact, the tribe which makes itself into a party. This party, which of its own will proclaims that it is a national party, and which claims to speak in the name of the totality of the people, secretly, sometimes even openly, organizes an authentic ethnic dictatorship. We no longer see the rise of a bourgeois dictatorship, but a tribal dictatorship. The ministers, the members of the cabinet, the ambassadors and local commissioners are chosen from the same ethnological group as the leader, sometimes directly from his own family. Such regimes of the family sort seem to go back to the old laws of inbreeding, and not anger but shame is felt when we are faced with such stupidity, such an imposture, such intellectual and spiritual poverty. These heads of the government are the true traitors in Africa, for they sell their country to the most terrifying of all its enemies, stupidity. This tribalizing of the central authority, it is certain, encourages regionalist ideas and separatism. All the decentralizing tendencies spring up again and triumph, and the nation falls to pieces, broken in bits. The leader, who once used to call for African unity and who thought of his own little family, wakes up one day to find himself saddled with five tribes who also want to have their own ambassadors and ministers, and irresponsible as ever, still unaware and still despicable, he denounces their treason. We have more than once drawn attention to the baleful influence frequently wielded by the leader. This is due to the fact that the party in certain districts is organized like a gang, with the toughest person in it as its head. The ascendancy of such a leader and his power over others is often mentioned, and people have no hesitation in declaring, in a tone of slightly admiring complicity, that he strikes terror into his nearest collaborators. In order to avoid these many pitfalls, an unceasing battle must be waged, a battle to prevent the party from ever becoming a willing tool in the hands of a leader. Leader. The word comes from the English verb to lead, but a frequent French translation is to drive. The driver, the shepherd of the people, no longer exists today. The people are no longer a herd. They do not need to be driven. If the leader drives me on, I want him to realize that at the same time, I show him the way. The nation ought not to be something bossed by a grand panegyrum. We must understand the panic caused in government circles each time one of these leaders falls ill. They are obsessed by the question of who is to succeed him. What will happen to the country if the leader disappears? The ruling classes who have abdicated in favor of the leader, irresponsible, oblivious of everything, and essentially preoccupied with the pleasures of their everyday life, their cocktail parties, their journeys paid for by government money, the profits they can make out of various schemes, from time to time these people discover the spiritual wasteland at the heart of the nation. A country that really wishes to answer the questions that history puts to it, that wants to develop not only its towns but also the brains of its inhabitants, such a country must possess a trustworthy political party. The party is not a tool in the hands of the government. Quite on the contrary, the party is a tool in the hands of the people. It is they who decide on the policy that the government carries out. The party is not and ought never to be the only political bureau where all the members of the government and the chief dignitaries of the regime may meet freely together. Only too frequently the political bureau, unfortunately, consists of all the party and its members who reside permanently in the capital. In an undeveloped country, the leading members of the party ought to avoid the capital as if it had the plague. They ought, with some few exceptions, to live in the country districts. The centralization of all activity in the city ought to be avoided. No excuse of administrative discipline should be taken as legitimizing that excrescence of a capital which is already overpopulated and overdeveloped with regard to 9/10 of the country. The party should be decentralized in the extreme. It is the only way to bring life to regions which are dead, those regions which are not yet awakened to life. In practice, there will be at least one member of the political bureau in each area, and he will deliberately not be appointed as head of that area. He will have no administrative powers. The regional member of the political bureau is not expected to hold the highest rank in the regional administrative organization. He ought not automatically to belong to the regional administrative body. For the people, the party is not an authority, but an organism through which they, as the people, exercise their authority and express their will. The less there is of confusion and duality of powers, the more the party will play its part of God, and the more surely it will constitute for the people a decisive guarantee. If the party is mingled with the government, the fact of being a party militant means that you take the shortcut to gain private ends. To hold a post in the government, step up the ladder, get promotion, and make a career for yourself. In an underdeveloped country, the setting up of a dynamic district officials stops the process whereby the towns become top-heavy and the incoherent rush toward the cities of the mass of country people. The setting up, early in the days of independence, of regional organizations and officials who have full authority to do everything in their power to awaken such a region, to bring life to it, and to hasten the growth of consciousness in it, is a necessity from which there is no escape for a country that wishes to progress. Otherwise, the government bigwigs and the party officials group themselves around the leader. The government services swell to huge proportions, not because they are developing and specializing, but because newfound cousins and fresh militants are looking for jobs and hope to edge themselves into the government machine. And the dream of every citizen is to get up to the capital and to have his share of the cake. The local districts are deserted. The mass of the country people, with no one to lead them, uneducated and unsupported, turn their backs on their poorly labored fields and flock toward the outer ring of suburbs, thus swelling out of all proportion the ranks of the lumpen proletariat. The moment for a fresh national crisis is not far off. To avoid it, we think that a quite different policy should be followed, that the interior, the back country, ought to be the most privileged part of the country. Moreover, in the last resort, there is nothing inconvenient in the government choosing its seat elsewhere than in the capital. The capital must be deconsecrated. The outcast masses must be shown that we have decided to work for them. It is with this idea in mind that the government of Brazil tried to found Brasilia. The dead city of Rio de Janeiro was an insult to the Brazilian people. But unfortunately, Brasilia is just another new capital, as monstrous as the first. The only advantage of this achievement is that today there exists a road through the bush to it. No, there is no serious reason which can be opposed to the choice of another capital, or to the moving of the government as a whole toward one of the most underpopulated regions. The capital of underdeveloped countries is a commercial notion inherited from the colonial period. But we who are citizens of the underdeveloped countries, we ought to seek every occasion for contacts with the rural masses. We must create a national policy, in other words, a policy for the masses. We ought never to lose contact with the people which has battled for its independence and for the concrete betterment of its existence. The native civil servants and technicians ought not to bury themselves in diagrams and statistics, but rather in the hearts of the people. They ought not to bristle up every time there is a question of a move to be made to the interior. We should no longer see the young women of the country threaten their husbands with divorce if they do not manage to avoid being appointed to a rural post. For these reasons, the political bureau of the party ought to treat these forgotten districts in a very privileged manner, and the life of the capital, an altogether artificial life which is struck onto the real national life like a foreign body, ought to take up the least space possible in the life of the nation, which is sacred and fundamental. In an underdeveloped country, the party ought to be organized in such a fashion that it is not simply content with having contacts with the masses. The party should be the direct expression of the masses. The party is not an administration responsible for transmitting government orders. It is the energetic spokesman and the incorruptible defender of the masses. In order to arrive at this conception of the party, we must above all rid ourselves of the very Western, very bourgeois, and therefore contemptuous attitude that the masses are incapable of governing themselves. In fact, experience proves that the masses understand perfectly the most complicated problems. One of the greatest services that the Algerian Revolution will have rendered to the intellectuals of Algeria will be to have placed them in contact with the people, to have allowed them to see the extreme, ineffable poverty of the people, at the same time allowing them to watch the awakening of the people's intelligence and the onward progress of their consciousness. The Algerian people, that mass of starving illiterates, those men and women plunged for centuries in the most appalling obscurity, have held out against tanks and airplanes, against napalm and, quote, psychological services, but above all against corruption and brainwashing, against traitors, and against the, quote, national armies of General Belloni. This people has held out in spite of hesitant or feeble individuals, and in spite of would-be dictators. This people has held out because for 7 years its struggle has opened up for it vistas that it never dreamed existed. Today, arms factories are working in the midst of the mountains, several yards underground. Today, the people's tribunals are functioning at every level, and local planning commissions are organizing the division of large-scale holdings and working out the Algeria of tomorrow. An isolated individual may obstinately refuse to understand a problem, but the group or the village understands with disconcerting rapidity. It is true that if care is taken to use only a language that is understood by graduates in law and economics, you can easily prove that the masses have to be managed from above. But if you speak the language of every day, if you are not obsessed by the perverse desire to spread confusion and to rid yourself of the people, then you will realize that the masses are quick to seize every shade of meaning and to learn all the tricks of the trade. If recourse is had to technical language, this signifies that it has been decided to consider the masses as uninitiated. Such a language is hard put to it to hide the lecturer's wish to cheat the people and to leave them out of things. The business of obscuring language is a mask behind which stands out the much greater business of plunder. The people's property and the people's sovereignty are to be stripped from them at one and the same time. Everything can be explained to the people on the single condition that you really want them to understand. And if you think that you don't need them, and that on the contrary they may hinder the smooth running of the many limited liability companies whose aim it is to make the people even poorer, then the problem is quite clear. For if you think that you can manage a country without letting the people interfere, if you think that the people upset the game by their mere presence, whether they slow it down or whether by their natural ignorance they sabotage it, then you must have no hesitation. You must keep the people out. Now, it so happens that when the people are invited to partake in the management of the country, they do not slow the movement down, but on the contrary, they speed it up. We Algerians have had the occasion and the good fortune during the course of this war to handle a fair number of questions. In certain country districts, the political-military leaders of the revolution found themselves, in fact, confronted with situations which called for radical solutions. We shall look at some of these situations. During the years 1956-57, French colonialism had marked off certain zones as forbidden, and within these zones, people's movements were strictly controlled. Thus, the peasants could no longer go freely to the towns and buy provisions. During this period, the grocers made huge profits. The prices of tea, coffee, sugar, tobacco, and salt soared. The black market flourished blatantly. The peasants who could not pay in money mortgaged their crops, in other words, their land, or else locked off field after field of their father's farms, and during the second phase, worked them for the grocer. As soon as the political commissioners realized the danger of the situation, they reacted immediately. Thus, a rational system of provisioning was instituted. The grocer who went to the town was obliged to buy from nationalist wholesalers who handed him an invoice which clearly showed the prices of the goods. When the retailer got back to the village, before doing anything else, he had to go to the political commissioner who checked the invoice, decided on the margin of profit, and fixed the price at which the various goods should be sold. However, the retailer soon discovered a new trick, and after 3 or 4 days, declared that his stocks had run out. In fact, he went on with his business of selling on the black market on the sly. The reaction of the politico-military authorities was thoroughgoing. Heavy penalizations were decided on, and the fines collected were put into the village funds and used for social purposes or to pay for public works in the general interest. Sometimes it was decided to shut down the shop for a while. Then, if there was a repetition of black marketeering, the business was at once confiscated, and a managing committee elected to carry it on, which paid a monthly allowance to the former owner. Taking these experiences as a starting point, the functioning of the main laws of economics was explained to the people with concrete examples. The accumulation of capital ceased to be a theory and became a very real and immediate mode of behavior. The people understood how that once a man was in trade, he could become rich and increase his turnover. Then and then only did the peasants tell the tale of how the grocer gave them loans at exorbitant interest, and others recalled how he evicted them from their land and how from owners they became laborers. The more the people understand, the more watchful they become, and the more they come to realize that finally everything depends on them, and their salvation lies in their own cohesion, in the true understanding of their interests, and in knowing who their enemies are. The people come to understand that wealth is not the fruit of labor, but the result of organized, protected robbery. Rich people are no longer respectable people. They are nothing more than flesh-eating animals, jackals, and vultures which wallow in the people's blood. With another end in view, the political commissioners have had to decide that nobody will work for anyone else any longer. The land belongs to those that till it. This is a principle which has, through explanation, become a fundamental law of the Algerian Revolution. The peasants who used to employ agricultural laborers have been obliged to give a share of the land to their former employees. So it may be seen that production per acre trebled, in spite of the many raids by the French, in spite of bombardments from the air, and the difficulty of getting manures. The fellahs, who at harvest time were able to judge and weigh the crops thus obtained, wanted to know whence came such a phenomenon, and they were quick to understand that the idea of work is not as simple as all that, that slavery is opposed to work, and that work presupposes liberty, responsibility, and consciousness. In those districts where we have been able to carry out successfully these interesting experiments, where we have watched men being created by revolutionary beginnings, the peasants have very clearly caught hold of the idea that the more intelligence you bring to your work, the more pleasure you will have in it. We have been able to make the masses understand that work is not simply the output of energy, nor the functioning of certain muscles, but that people work more by using their brains and their hearts than with only their muscles and their sweat. In the same way, in these liberated districts, which are at the same time excluded from the old trade routes, we have had to modify production, which formerly looked only toward the towns and toward export. We have organized production to meet consumers' needs for the people and for the units of the National Army of Liberation. We have quadrupled the production of lentils and organized the manufacture of charcoal. Green vegetables and charcoal have been sent through the mountains from the north to the south, whereas the southern districts send meat to the north. This coordination was decided upon by the FLN, and it was they who set up the system of communications. We did not have any technicians or planners coming from big Western universities, but in these liberated regions, the daily ration went up to the hitherto unheard of figure of 3,200 calories. The people were not content with coming triumphant out of this test. They started asking themselves theoretical questions. For example, why did certain districts never see an orange before the War of Liberation, while thousands of tons are exported every year abroad? Why were grapes unknown to a great many Algerians, whereas the European peoples enjoyed them by the million? Today, the people have a very clear notion of what belongs to them. The Algerian people today know that they are the sole owners of the soil and mineral wealth of their country. And if some individuals do not understand the unrelenting refusal of the FLN to tolerate any encroachment on this right of ownership, and its fierce refusal to allow any compromise on principles, they must one and all remember that the Algerian people is today an adult people, responsible and fully conscious of its responsibilities. In short, the Algerians are men of property. If we have taken the example of Algeria to illustrate our subject, it is not at all with the intention of glorifying our own people, but simply to show the important part played by the war in leading them toward consciousness of themselves. It is clear that other peoples have come to the same conclusion in different ways. We know for sure today that in Algeria the test of force was inevitable. But other countries, through political action and through the work of clarification undertaken by a party, have led their people to the same results. In Algeria, we have realized that the masses are equal to the problems which confront them. In an underdeveloped country, experience proves that the important thing is not that 300 people form a plan and decide upon carrying it out, but that the whole people plan and decide, even if it takes them twice or three times as long. The fact is that the time taken up by explaining, the time lost in treating the worker as a human being, will be caught up in the execution of the plan. People must know where they are going and why. The politician should not ignore the fact that the future remains a closed book, so long as the consciousness of the people remains imperfect, elementary, and cloudy. We African politicians must have very clear ideas on the situation of our people, but this clarity of ideas must be profoundly dialectical. The awakening of the whole people will not come about all at once. The people's work in the building of the nation will not immediately take on its full dimensions. First, because the means of communication and transmission are only beginning to be developed. Secondly, because the yardstick of time must no longer be that of the moment or up to the next harvest, but must become that of the rest of the world. And lastly, because the spirit of discouragement, which has been deeply rooted in people's mind by colonial domination, is still very near the surface. But we must not overlook the fact that victory over these weaknesses, which are the heritage of the material and spiritual domination of the country by another, is a necessity from which no government will be able to escape. Let us take the example of work under the colonial regime. The settler never stopped complaining that the native is slow. Today, in certain countries which have become independent, we hear the ruling classes taking up the same cry. The fact is that the settler wanted the native to be enthusiastic. By a sort of process of mystification, which constitutes the most sublime type of separation from reality, he wanted to persuade the slave that the land that he worked belonged to him, that the mines where he lost his health were owned by him. The settler was singularly forgetful of the fact that he was growing rich through the death throes of the slave. In fact, what the settler was saying to the native was, "Kill yourself that I may become rich." Today, we must behave in a different fashion. We ought not to say to the people, "Kill yourselves that the country may become rich." If we want to increase the national revenue and decrease the importing of certain products which are useless or even harmful, if we want to increase agricultural production and overcome illiteracy, we must explain what we are about. The people must understand what is at stake. Public business ought to be the business of the public. So the necessity of creating a large number of well-informed nuclei at the bottom crops up again. Too often, in fact, we are content to establish national organizations at the top and always in the capital. The Women's Union, the Young People's Federation, trade unions, etc. But if one takes the trouble to investigate what is behind the office in the capital, if you go into the inner room where the reports ought to be, you will be shocked by the emptiness, the blank spaces, and the bluff. There must be a basis. There must be cells that supply content and life. The masses should be able to meet together, discuss, propose, and receive directions. The citizens should be able to speak, to express themselves, and to put forward new ideas. The branch meeting and the committee meeting are liturgical acts. They are privileged occasions given to a human being to listen and to speak. At each meeting, the brain increases its means of participation and the eye discovers a landscape more and more in keeping with human dignity.
Context of white supremacy. That is where we'll pick up at. For me, that puts us at the top of page 195. For me, it's top of 195, so we'll be picking up the next paragraph. It reads, "The large proportion of young people in the underdeveloped countries." That's what we'll pick up at for audio segment number two. Again, welcome back, folks that are with us live, archives. We have not done our book club in a couple of weeks. I've had a very painful conclusion to the summer of 2017, but thankfully, I am feeling way better. I'm about 98% back to normal health, probably another week, and I'll be completely straight. But thanks for the folks who were patient, hanging in while I was trying to recuperate. And we are back for another session, France Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. If you would like to dial in, share thoughts on the first portion of the reading from this week, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to join in, but you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinytiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tinytiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page, click the link. It says free vote line. Should open a small window on your screen. First line, drop down menu, select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in your real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you are comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button. It will connect you to the live broadcast. Same procedure. If you would like to participate, you should hear us live once you're connected. Look on your screen. You'll see the dial pad. Press star 6. I'll see your hand on the switchboard, and we will get you on the line. Right on. Folks who have dialed in, if you have any comments you would like to share, first audio segment, Mr. Franz Fanon, line should be open. Proceed. Look at that. Mr. Demery 4, right there, ready to participate. Good to hear from you, sir. Oh, are you?
Greetings, Matthew.
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Glad that you're feeling better. Seemed like you had some struggles there at first, but it looked like you got a handle on everything. Those wisdom teeth can be sunk.
Amen.
I took the opportunity for the last couple of weeks to read on and, take some notes. But the conclusion that I've come to, it seems to me, to kind of sum it all up, is that he was using the Algerian Revolution as an example and other so-called, uprisings or independence, movements towards independence in African countries to stress his point. But then how about the French Revolution? He was so-called, he was born in France, and there was, other revolutions, that white people were involved in. I'm sure that if all of these scenarios fit the underdeveloped countries, the non-white individuals, then if it was true, then it would hold firm with every revolution, even revolutions from white people. But it seems that there's constant putting down of non-white people's movements towards independence. Even after they gain their independence, then according to him, that they're uneducated. They don't have the money in order to run the country. And then where in other revolutions, the bourgeoisie phase takes over, then in the underdeveloped countries, those bourgeoisie is there to steal from the people, not to develop the country. And then he goes on to contradict himself that there are some individuals that have the country's interests in mind that want to do the right thing. But, you know, he said these people should be brought to the front, but where do you find them? You know, when you've got forces working against you, you're trying to be independent. The colonialists are constantly trying to hold you back. So they send it in provocateurs and people to infiltrate your so-called parties, whatever you bring together, to try to unite. And you really don't get anywhere. And it said somewhere in the book that you realize that after all the fighting and all that, your independence wasn't really independence at all. And then you have to start all over from the beginning. But like you say, I don't think the book aged that well, because there have been revolutions that managed to make it through this process. And, you know, what brings to mind is South Africa when you think about this. And a lot of this fits into the mold that he's bringing forth, you know, about the leaders, you know, and the people that are appointed to positions of authority is usually part of the tribal ancestry and even family members. Well, that's also true in European countries also. They did the same thing. I thought it was interesting that he said the word leader in the English was to lead, but in French it was to drive. And that, see, that would create a problem right there. If you had a country that was being driven off of slave labor or some people you had to drive, and then they become independent, and you no longer drive those people, you're not going to have the same production level. So all of this is kind of common sense. But one last thing I want to bring up is when he was referring to the colonialists forgot, strangely enough, that he was getting rich on the agony of the slave. In fact, what the colonists were saying to the colonized subject was, work yourself to death, but let me get rich. Today, we should proceed differently. We must not say to the people, work yourself to death, but let the country get rich. You know, that statement, you know, the beginning of the statement is just not true. You know, white people know what they're doing. They've been working us to death for going on, what, 600-700 years. And, they know exactly what they're doing. They got the strategies down. And the way you use mystification and mind altering is one of the techniques that they use. I'll just mute my line and get somebody else a chance. Thanks, Scott.
Indeed. Good to hear from you, Mr. Demery Ford. And reading is more important than watching television, Mr. Demery, continuing with the read even when the cows was not on the air. Brilliant. Outstanding. If other folks have commentary they want to share, feel free. Star 6 1 if you have comments on the first portion of the text. I am certainly going to get in my comments. I will say, with the back injury and then consecutive weeks of having two wisdom teeth extracted, that was on Thursday, and so then the next day, 24 hours after that, the book club. So that's 2 weeks in a row. I had a mouthful of gauze and sat there and was like, man, you know, we can try and go ahead with the book club. I guess just for perspective, like, this is not in the Guinness Book of World Records, but just for perspective sake, in the 5 years plus, 5.5 years that we've been doing the book club here on The Cows, we have not done the book club exactly, 2 times in the last 5 years prior to last month with the back injuries. Again, not in the Guinness Book of World Records, but I mean, generally, we're here on Friday. One of those Fridays, I did not have my computer. It was being serviced, not able to broadcast. The other time, this year, when President Donald J. Trump was being inaugurated, we did broadcast that one day. We just didn't do the book club. But man, I would sit there and be like, man, you know, let's try and see if we can do it. You know, you don't have to do a lot of talking. It's the book club. I can say this book is not one that motivated Gus T. Renegade to be like, oh, yeah, I'm literally going to suck it up. I'll put extra gauze in my mouth and, you know, I have my ibuprofen and everything. See if we can, you know, get through it. I might sound a little funny and be a little loopy since I'll be on medication. But man, knowing that this is the book that I'll be doing all that to read, that did not motivate me to try and suck it up at all. It's just like, oh, my Lord, I cannot believe we still have quite a few of those left. Like, I'm going to gripe about this book until we are done. Thankfully, we're beyond the halfway point. And I said from the beginning, I did not want to read this book. Listeners unanimously selected this book. I said specifically I would have selected Black Skin, White Mask. It is much smaller. I think we would have been done with that book, and we would have still had reasonably same flavor of what some of Fanon's writings offer. Now, I am a victim of racism. I am ignorant. I might not be understanding Fanon. I think one of the clips that we played previously, some of the whites that were celebrating this book, they said that anyone who tells you that they understand what Fanon wrote in this book is not telling the truth. I tend to agree with them. It's just, for me, it's just not a book I would recommend that non-white people read. If you want accurate information about racism, white supremacy, that will help you better understand what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be white, like just basic fundamental things about what racism, what do we mean when we say racism, just things like that. And, you know, there are many books that I would say are similar, especially when people talk about racism. And again, he's married to a white person. This would apply, you know, to anybody. If they put out a work, it's going to be I'm going to be much more critical, much more suspicious of a work that is put out by someone who is in some sort of tragic arrangement with a white person and is being, you know, celebrated for a half century by whites, race soldiers, saying, oh, yeah, this is the greatest revolutionary book in the history of Negro writing. I mean, whew, man, to hear that, I mean, oh, man, you're going to have a very difficult time. The burden of proof is going to be astronomical, and this is not close. And if anything, I would emphasize, when you hear people celebrate this book, people should ask questions. The people that have been disciplined enough to sit through this, you should ask questions in terms of, really, what exactly, you know, do you think is worthwhile about the book? What would you recommend specifically? Do you have some thoughts or portions that specifically stood out as being significant to you in understanding problems we face and how to get things done? I would have questions, and even more than that, perhaps, for anybody who was coming forward and saying, oh, yeah, this is a really great book and something that people need to, even if you're, you know, saying, yeah, violence is a part of it. Fine. I think there are other better books that address that subject matter as well. I will try and pick out some of the things that I highlighted. One of the things that I am doing so that I won't be super surly the whole time that I'm going through this is the book that we will be doing next, Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk by Neil Postman. Wow, I'm so looking forward to reading that again. I read that book 10 years ago. Mr. Postman wrote other books that I also think are very constructive, but it's all about words and how not using words correctly causes a lot of our problems and things that can be done to remedy that. Neil Postman, Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk. And I think that book might be out of print. I had a copy on my wish list. The first time I read it, I had to get it from the library, but I think that book might be out of print. Anyway, that's what I'm doing to keep my spirits buoyed as we slog through the remainder of this. Let's see, some of the notes that I took from this week. And some of the problem that I have, one of the first notes that I took, for me, this is on 174. The theoretical question that for the last 50 years has been raised whenever the history of underdeveloped countries is under discussion, whether or not the bourgeois phase can be skipped, ought to be answered in the field of revolutionary action and not by logic. Eyebrow raise for anyone who's a fan of Mr. Fuller. Follow the logic. But his much of his analysis seems as though it is using some sort of class analysis, even if some people have said he had to stretch the typical white class analysis to make it better fit and to better incorporate racism, white supremacy. But be that as it may, he has a lot of this in the way that he presents what's happening on the continent, what's happening in Algeria, and some of the difficulties that black people face in trying to head towards liberation and in colonialism, quote unquote. But just this, the bourgeois this, and the black middle class this, and the lumpen proletariat this, all of this Marxist analysis, just confusion and beyond confusion. I mean, yes, it does produce confusion, but it is not accurate. When Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, when she came on this program and said repeatedly, she would reference and say, I used to consider myself a Marxist-Leninist. And she said her grandparents used to check her and be like, man, the more education they get, the dumber they get. I mean, really think about that and how they are able, white racist man, racist woman, how they are able to get generation after generation of black people to imbibe that nonsense, inaccurate view of what's happening on the planet. No, it's not racism, white supremacy. It's about money. It's about finance. It's about class. Didn't Kanye West just say that? Didn't Kanye West just say that within the last few years or so, after he'd had all these problems with racism, that is, you know, it's not about race. It's about class. It's about money. So many non-white people get confused. And in my view, when you have a text like this that has that confusion baked right in the center of it, that is how the confusion gets passed on from one generation to the next. That, oh yeah, Fanon, he, you know, says, yeah, the black middle class is a big part of the problem, man. And, you know, we got to get this together. Look, class analysis, man. It's not just about racism here. We got a lot of class issues going on. And it just goes from one to, again, I could be wrong. In my view, I think that could be a part of what's happening on page. For me, this is 182. Let's see. The heads of government, the heads of government are the true traitors in Africa, for they sell their country to the most terrifying of all its enemies, stupidity. Again, I would say the heads, or there's only one government on the planet, that is the system of racism, white supremacy, and the heads of that government are racist man, racist woman, racist child. I think anytime non-white people get confused about that, and thinking that the people that are in charge are some individuals who are classified as not white, there's going to be mass confusion. And at least to me, that seems like a lot of what is happening in terms of not grasping, or I would say maybe placing more culpability on what's happening here and why these things, in the effort to end quote-unquote colonialism, why these things are happening and why you're getting black people who are not, they don't have the best interest of all of the other black people at hand. They're just trying to get as much as they can for themselves individually and are doing things to quote-unquote sell the people out. Why these things are happening? Because racists have decided this is what we're going to do. Okay, we can move back a few yards. We'll pick out, you know, a few niggers and say that they are in charge. Hey, this might even work down the road stateside. Got a little fellow over here. We might, anyway, you know, they could run this strategy very well and be scientific about it and already know what's going to happen. Already have their contingency plan set up. If things go a little bit awry, if they need to take him out, put he or she put in a new leader and say that they're in charge. They can even go grab somebody. Hey, we had this fella in prison for 27 years. We'll pull him out and say that he is the leader. Any way we want to do it. That's what racism, white supremacy means. And I just, most of us, myself included, we don't understand that. And it can lead to a lot of confusion and directing anger at other non-white people when they are not the person that, the person to blame for why these things are happening. Also, just thought, selling their country to the most terrifying of all enemies, stupidity, sounds like a metaphor to me. I could be in error. Next. The native civil servants and technicians ought not to bury themselves in diagrams and statistics, but rather in the hearts of the people. Sounds like another metaphor to me. And I'm not really sure what that means, if that's supposed to suggest or convey some sort of commitment to all of the black people there and their betterment. You know, I can understand. I guess, you know, if that's what he means, I can see where that's constructive and looking out for other people. See, we're just reading the rest with that paragraph. They ought not to bristle up every time there's a question of a move to be made to the interior, quote unquote. We should no longer see the young women of the country threaten their husbands with divorce if they do not manage to avoid being appointed to a rural post. For these reasons, the political bureau of the party ought to treat these forgotten districts in a very privileged manner. Yeah, just like I said, for me, a lot of this, it just seems like it has not aged very well, and or might not be applicable if you are a black person, non-white person, you reside in a different part of the world. Some of this just might be not applicable to you, and that's fine too. Racism, white supremacy is worldwide, doesn't operate exactly the same everywhere, and certainly it changes over periods of time. Let's see. This, for me, I think is 192, bottom of 192. We African politicians must have very clear ideas of the situation of our people, but this clarity of ideas must be profoundly dialectical. I stopped when I read that sentence and I said, how curious, because this book seems so alarmingly unclear to me in terms of direction and, you know, what suggestions we have in terms of things to do. And like I said at the beginning, what racism, white supremacy is, what does it mean to be classified as white? Just fundamental things in terms of this text just does not seem clear to me. And it seems that other people who've read this book have also come to that conclusion. But yeah, just to me, it does not seem like a logical presentation of ideas that can be clearly, lucidly understood. This portion continues, the awakening of the whole people will not come about all at once. The people's work in the building of the nation will not immediately take on its full dimensions. First, because the means of communication and transmission are only beginning to be developed. Now that portion, A plus. I thought that was great. I agree with that. Reading this book, for me, it was not worth it just to get that. There have been, you know, some other things that I thought were constructive, but I mean, this way pales in comparison to everything else that I've had to endure in reading the text so far. But absolutely, I think with the replacing of white supremacy, it's not an immediate thing. It is a process. I think that's why I've said before, I'm not an advocate of the metaphor, people staying woke, or anything that suggests that, or someone got their wake up call, quote unquote. To me, all of that, it suggests that learning about racism, white supremacy is waking up, and that's not what it is at all. Waking up is an instantaneous thing for most people. Learning about racism, white supremacy might take years. It could take a long time of study and thought to figure things out. And at least I can speak for myself. I am still learning. Continuing. And when he says the building of a nation, I just, in my view, I think establishment of justice, replacing white supremacy with justice. That is the nation building he's talking about in my mind. That's how I process it. Even the portion where he says the means of communication and transmission are only beginning to be developed. Absolutely. And hopefully with this broadcast, the next book we're reading, Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk, Neil Postman, that is a part of the refining how we understand words as tools that can be used in dismantling the system of white supremacy. Continuing where he says, lastly, because the spirit of discouragement, which has been deeply rooted in people's minds by colonial domination, is still very near the surface. I think that is very important as well in going about this work. Racists, it's so easy for them to discourage us. And I mean, logically speaking, you can understand how any black person would be discouraged. Given everything that has happened, I think just being realistic about that for ourselves and other black people is very important. And just already having things in mind, as another psychiatrist that we have talked about a lot used to say, be not discouraged. Very important to keep that in mind from the beginning. Some of the other things that I highlighted, let's see. Mm-hmm. where he said, this is on 193, the settler was singularly forgetful. Oh, Mr. Demery Ford read that. I'll just make sure I get the sentence out. The settler was singularly forgetful of the fact that he was growing rich through the death throes of the slave. Again, just for me, that is massively incorrect. And something that's massively incorrect about that, I've written about this, I talk about this on a regular basis, white people are not, they cannot be ignorant about racism. If there is a system of white supremacy, individuals classified as white cannot be ignorant, forgetful about racism, white supremacy. That is absurd. And these consistent articles and posts that suggest white people are ignorant or ill-informed or unaware or fragile or all of this, it's nonsense. It is total nonsense. And it's even, in my view, it's worse than that because it's dangerous. It's giving non-white people inaccurate information about what it means to be white, what racism, white supremacy is, and how it works is dangerous, can be fatal. And here it is again in a text that is widely celebrated. In my view, it's more celebrated than Dr. Welsing's text. Now, certainly this is a lot older than Dr. Welsing, but I don't hear, you know, legions of white people were celebrating Fanon when he was alive. Jean-Paul Sartre wrote the introduction that we labored through. But I don't hear white people, you know, running around celebrating Dr. Welsing regularly, not on a mainstream level, certainly the way that they do with Frantz Fanon. And in my view, a part of that is because he has statements like this that are just flagrantly incorrect. And if non-white people are thinking this, that, yeah, white people, they're just ignorant. They don't understand that they're just killing us with all the things that they are doing, diverting rescue efforts to help out hounds and dogs in Houston or Florida, or making sure that black people are living in areas with chock full of pollution and what have you, that these things are killing black and everything else that they're doing to wage war against us. They thoroughly understand that. Like, anything that suggests that they're ignorant about that, in my opinion, is astronomically dangerous. And I'll give a pause there. Do we have any other folks who dialed in who had commentary? I know we haven't been on in a couple of weeks, but I will again assert this book was a unanimous listener choice, so we definitely should not have spectators. If I'm having to stick it out, listen to the rest of the text, then other folks should as well, especially if you voted to read this book, and or just other folks if you're paying attention for the book club. If you have any thoughts, if you have thought about in the interim since we weren't on, why this text is so beloved, even if you had a chance to ask some black people, if you know any, who say that they read this book and it had a, you know, impact on them, or they even had thoughts on it, have a chit chat with them and see what they say. If this is the first time for anyone listening, reading the text, I do not see other hands at this point. Can't say it's the most enthralling text. Mr. Demery Ford, did you have any other comments you wanted to get in, sir?
Yes, Reverend Eric.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that part when he got onto the youth in the underdeveloped countries is in most cases marketed entertainment from the industrialized countries. Then he goes in to state that, you know, what the commissioners of youth should do in the underdeveloped countries, you know, to try to, I guess, improve the conditions of the youth because of their idle and illiterate condition, which we know the cause of, you know, this, whites are the cause of this. And then it said that they see their role as equivalent to that of the commissioner of youth in the developed country. They talk of the fortifying the soul, developing the body, and encouraging talent in sports. And then they go on to say that the youth in Africa should not be oriented towards stadiums, but towards the fields. The fields and... Well, let me know if I'm getting ahead. Did we cover this in the region? Because I was going to make the point that, okay, am I ahead?
I think you might be a little bit ahead.
Oh, okay. Okay, I was just going to say, he was talking about the consciousness of the athletes, and even in situations where, well, I know in this country, with Colin Kaepernick, you know, he's very conscious. An athlete is conscious. They got consequences for that, too. So I guess somebody else a chance. I'm moving along a little fast here. All right. Thanks, guys.
I'm double checking. It seems like that's right at the cutoff point. Either it's right at the end or right where we're picking up at for the second half. I lost my placeholder of where we're picking up at the second half at, but that the portion that you just read, either it's coming right up or we just covered it right at the end. I lost my page folder. The other people there dialed in with a hand up while I clear up where we ended exactly. The caller at 4757 and Emmy, you all are both with us if you have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi there, this is Mel. So I came in on the tail end of the first section. I'll be here for the entire second section, though. But my comment was there's a part at the tail end of it where he says that people need to, I think the masses need to put aside their differences and come together and, I guess, speak as one or try to put aside, I guess, some of their subcategories of political differences, like it's women's rights or I'm not sure what rights he wanted to put aside, but I think he said come together as a mass. And part of me was wondering, does, if you're in a location where your masses happen to be mostly white and you're actually the minority, is he talking about the masses of minority or is he talking about the masses in general coming together? Because as he was talking about breaking down, I guess, walls to speak as one, I guess I wasn't sure of the context. And if he is talking about coming together, speaking as one, was it for Wallism or not? Like, did he mean for people to literally come together, and was it based on geography? So that was the part that confused me, but I think that might have just been me not hearing that whole first section. But something I did hear that I did agree with was when he said that when you have all these subcategories, I guess he said you would be surprised that when you go behind into the desks and the cabinets of people who are politicians for you, you would be surprised by how little those categorizations matter to them, how they have, I guess, a different set of categorizations for you. Something about dashes and spaces and slashes or something like that. I that's what I interpreted from that. And I'm thinking that's probably very true. What we think we are and what other people know us as, probably two different things sometimes. When we, maybe if people are, for instance, calling themselves Black Lives Matter or something like that, they're probably being lumped in with other types of groups, or, you know, certain religious groups are being lumped, I guess, behind the curtain as to what we are all really called and stuff. So that's what that brought to my mind. And also if there are other racial classifications that we're, I guess, being categorized as. That was it. Thank you.
Great to hear from Mel. Again, looking forward. Stupid talk, crazy talk. Got my book. Super excited. Emmy, did you have commentary? You should be with us as well.
Reading. In listening to the text, I'm not really as focused on everything as I was in the beginning, only because, for me, he's focusing too much on non-white people, and I don't hear enough about the so-called, what he calls the colonizers and whatnot, i.e. white people. So, and in the beginning when we talked a lot about the quote-unquote bourgeoisie, I thought it was relevant, but I think we're just so far into the text that I don't see any relevance in it at all. And I feel like perhaps this is his, because he's a psychiatrist, so he would be in that bourgeoisie category of people that he's kind of talking about. So when I'm listening to the text, I'm wondering how much of it is just kind of what he himself feels, like when he's talking about the desire to kind of be different, or when you think that you're different but you're not, in terms of when you're Black and you think that you can elevate, but then you realize that you're not really elevated. I was looking at something, and there's like some kit that you could order. Someone was promoting their business, and I guess it's like a pro-black starter kit or something, and Wretched of the Earth was in there. And then I, of course, thought about the book club, and I think that black people promote this book because white people promote this book. I don't think that there's anything in here, for me at least, that is really helpful or constructive or would really make me say, hey, this is definitely a book. I think it's just one that everyone should read. I think it's just one of those things that once white people have put a stamp on it, then it must be of great value. I think that white people appreciate it or put a stamp on it because I think it's the closest you can get to being, I don't think it's the closest, but I think maybe at the time or maybe in its way, it is closer to sounding constructive or that it's really speaking about something without actually speaking about it while he has his white wife, which when you know all of that stuff together means that he would be like a revolutionary safe Negro. I know that might be a metaphor, but I think that's how it could be interpreted, that if he's so able to see what he's able to see and write this whole text and whatever other text, books he's written and have this insight, but he's with a white woman, then he's safer than the others who might say this. Because I don't know if that's making as much sense, but I just think that it relates to them that this is what a safe revolutionary conversation or book or text would sound like. And I just kind of get that feeling that that's where they would want the conversation to be, because he himself sounds confused. And it's for me, I'm not even sure what's different in the text now than in the very beginning when we started reading it. I feel like he's just saying the exact same thing over and over and over again. And then there might be like a sentence or so that might be different, but to me it just seems the same. And he says in many different ways, I don't have that translation and I'm not looking at my translation, but he says how things are written so that the indigenous folks or the native folks or the people who are not bourgeoisie, proletariat, whatever term he's using, don't understand it. And that's all I feel about this book, that it's just a very long, tedious book that's not written so that an average reader could understand what you're trying to say. And I think as a scientist, as a doctor, as a psychiatrist, he should have known better and should have defined these words that he's using. And he does not do that at all. So then I'm not really sure. So my whole thing now with the text is, why'd you even write it? Did you even write it? Because right now I'm just told that you wrote it. Did you? Like, how much did your wife write? Or, like, what was this? Because it's not helpful at all. And it's just something to me that people just jumped on a bandwagon with. So, thank you.
What else is in the Black Revolutionary Starter Pack, like a copy of Wretched of the Earth, and what else?
I didn't even see, because it was a photo on Instagram, and I was like just scrolling, and I was like, whatever. But I'll try to look. I will scroll back again and see if I can see, because it wasn't an itemized list. It was like they took a picture of what they were going to send out, and I was able to just see the cover of the book. But I'll look.
Right on. Definitely. I don't know. I might have to run the other way with that one. But yeah, the person that dialed in, last four digits 3637. Did you have commentary?
Hello, everyone. Who's calling from the 712 calling? I didn't get to listen to the first beginning of the book for this week, but I really appreciate you putting part three in the iTunes so I can go listen to it and try to understand this book a little bit better. But when Dr. Wilson was talking about that Marxism, she said that made me think of when I was at school, because in ethics, I think it was ethics, we learned about Marxism, and I too was sucked in to Marxism, because it seemed like that's it, right? It got to be money is what's really going on. And back then, in the early 2000s, when I was going to school, I didn't have as much knowledge as I do now about the whole system of racism. So it sounded good. And I also had to tell my daughter, because she just went to university, and I told her to watch out for Marxism, because it's going to sound like it's the answer, but it's not. So I had to tell her about that. And I want to say about The Wretched of the Earth, maybe people pick this book because of the title, Gus and other listeners. And I want to put that out there, because Wretched of the Earth, just the title of that is like, oh, wow, this must be amazing. Like, we have to read this. And maybe that's why people picked it. I didn't pick it, but when I heard that we was reading Frantz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, I was like, oh, wow, this is going to be interesting. Look at that title. And then we got Black Face, White Mask, which is, you know, a good title, but it doesn't sound as dramatic and as I don't know, seems like some people would gravitate to a title like that. So maybe that's why everybody chose it. But to me, I think they're promoting it. The racist white supremacists are promoting this book because this book is confusing. I said that in a couple of other readings. This book is confusing, and so they promote this book to us because it will confuse us. And that's one of the main tools of the racist, is confusing the non-white victims. And that's all I have right now. Thank you for letting me share.
For sure. And I do want to make sure, because I think this is the most critical that I've been of any of the books that we've read on the book study. This program is nearly a decade old, but the book study specifically, 5.5 years. I think we have a pretty impressive catalog of reading that we've done on the book club here. George Orwell, President Obama, Dr. Marimba Ani, Yorugu, Toni Morrison. I mean, we have read a lot. Chinua Achebe, we have read a lot of authors down through the years, white, black, folks that are international authors, lots of folks. And I don't recall ever being so dissatisfied with a book. I think this... It's not even saying anything, because I don't remember complaining about a book while we were reading it, like from the very beginning, complaining about a book that I had already read. I just don't think that's happened. Like, this is easily the worst book that we've done on the book club. And again, that's one of those where I would say, now, most of the people that talk about racism, white supremacy, either they are incorrect or I am incorrect, because some things, there's wide divergence. This is one, again, where they're saying the answer, if this was a math problem, this is not. They said the answer was 2, and I'm saying the answer is 2.1. This is like, you have a whole lot of people who are saying this is the greatest book ever that you need to read to understand racism and what's happening to black people. They're saying the answer is like 102, and I'm saying the answer is like -5 billion. You can skip this completely. There are a lot of other books if you want to learn about whatever it is, colonialism, racism, white supremacy, what was happening in Algiers, what was happening in Martinique, what was happening with anti-colonialism movements in the 1960s. There are a lot of better books that you could read on any of those subjects. You should skip this one. Do we have anybody else who had comments they wanted to get in before we get to audio segment number 2? Right on. That is one thing that I will say. Even if I'm reading a book that I don't like, I do try to have the discipline to finish it. Again, I have never had the urge. I mean, we'd taken so much time. I was like, wow, I wonder if we could just fast forward and get to Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk, because that is a book I'm very excited to read. But I've never had that urge with any book that we've done on the book club in 5.5. And just to make that point, that's going to be the introduction for next week. That's something I've been meaning to do all year, because that is one thing I'm generally not impressed about anything that, you know, I've done or we've done with the cows, because just the problem is not solved. But that is one thing. I did take a gander at our book list, the books that we've read, and I said, wow, I think if you read even half of the books that we've read on the book club over the 5.5 years that we've been reading, you will substantially increase your understanding of racism, white supremacy, and maybe even some other topics, because we've read some books that aren't even directly How to Win Friends and Influence People. We read that too. I think you will, you know, boost your IQ on racism, white supremacy. If you read some of those books, not even, you don't even have to listen to the book club that we did. You could read the books independently. And I still think you would probably gain quite a bit of insight for some of the texts that we've read. This just isn't one of them, unfortunately. Getting to audio segment number two, France Fanon, the wretched of the earth, with his dramatic title. I have to ask people that. How did they, if they've read the book, if they've read the book cover to cover, because I suspect there's probably a lot of that too, that people get this book and they don't read it, like they have it on the shelf and it looks nice, or they have it on the coffee table. They read a paragraph or a chapter or so maybe and put it down. See if they read the entire book. And then you can go and ask your questions from there. Anyway, this is... Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Oh, I was going to say that Chapter 5, Yorugu and Dr. Anit's book starts out with a phrase from Franz Fanon. I can't recall.
I got my book.
Yeah, you can probably research Chapter 5. All right.
That's great. Let's see. If I can get my hand on my book from here, I will read it now. Let's see if I can reach it from right here. Oh, I think I can. Let's see. Yorugu, that was the very first book that we did in the study session, just for comparison's sake. Okay, Yorugu chapter 5. Let's see. Okay, up, let's see. So chapter 5 in Yorugu, The Image of Others. Her quote, "The nature is declared insensible to ethics. He represents not only the absence of values, but also the negation of values. He is, ellipsis, the enemy of values, the absolute evil. He is the corrosive element, destroying all that comes near him. He is the deforming element, disfiguring all that has to do with beauty of morality. He is the depository of malfeasant powers, the unconscious and irretrievable instrument of blind forces, ellipsis. All the values, in fact, are irrevocably poisoned and diseased as soon as they are allowed in contact with the colonized race. The customs of the colonized people, their traditions, their myths, above all their myths, are the very sign of that poverty of the spirit and their constitutional depravity." That is a nice passage cleaned up at the end of the day. He still married a white woman, and that, for me, steals some of the power even from a sentence like that. And I think if you go through this book, you can curb out, you know, a section, a paragraph or two here or there. But even this paragraph had to be cleaned up. They did have to chop out some. I said there are a couple of, that's why I read where the ellipses are in this portion, because even this had to be cleaned up a little bit, because it, the tendency to not be coherent as it continues throughout the text. But while I go to section two, I'll find out if we already read this portion or if this is something that is coming up in the text. With that, moving to the second audio segment, France Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, Context of White Supremacy.
The large proportion of young people in the underdeveloped countries raises specific problems for the government, which must be tackled with lucidity. The young people of the towns, idle and often illiterate, are a prey to all sorts of disintegrating influences. It is to the youth of an underdeveloped country that the industrialized countries most often offer their pastimes. Normally, there is a certain homogeneity between the mental and material level of the members of any given society and the pleasures which that society creates for itself. But in underdeveloped countries, young people have at their disposition leisure occupations designed for the youth of capitalist countries. Detective novels, penny in the slot machines, sexy photographs, pornographic literature, films banned to those under 16, and above all, alcohol. In the West, the family circle, the effects of education, and the relatively high standard of living of the working classes provide a more or less efficient protection against the harmful action of these pastimes. But in an African country, where mental development is uneven, where the violent collision of two worlds has considerably shaken old traditions and thrown the universe of the perceptions out of focus, the impressionability and sensibility of the young African are at the mercy of the various assaults made upon them by the very nature of Western culture. His family very often proves itself incapable of showing stability and homogeneity when faced with such attacks. In this domain, the government's duty is to act as a filter and a stabilizer, but the youth commissioners in underdeveloped countries often make the mistake of imagining their role to be that of youth commissioners in fully developed countries. They speak of strengthening the soul, of developing the body, and of facilitating the growth of sportsmanlike qualities. It is our opinion that they should beware of these conceptions. The young people of an underdeveloped country are above all idle. Occupations must be found for them. For this reason, the youth commissioners ought, for practical purposes, to be attached to the Ministry of Labor. The Ministry of Labor, which is a prime necessity in an underdeveloped country, functions in collaboration with the Ministry of Planning, which is another necessary institution in underdeveloped countries. The youth of Africa ought not to be sent to sports stadiums, but into the fields and into the schools. The stadium ought not to be a show place erected in the towns, but a bit of open ground in the midst of the fields that the young people must reclaim, cultivate, and give to the nation. The capitalist conception of sport is fundamentally different from that which should exist in an underdeveloped country. The African politician should not be preoccupied with turning out sportsmen, but with turning out fully conscious men who play games as well. If games are not integrated into the national life, that is to say, in the building of the nation, and if you turn out national sportsmen and not fully conscious men, you will very quickly see sport rotted by professionalism and commercialism. Sport should not be a pastime or a distraction for the bourgeoisie of the towns. The greatest task before us is to understand at each moment what is happening in our country. We ought not to cultivate the exceptional or to seek for a hero, who is another form of a leader. We ought to uplift the people. We must develop their brains, fill them with ideas, change them, and make them into human beings. We once more come up against that obsession of ours, which we would like to see shared by all African politicians, about the need for effort to be well informed. For work is enlightened and freed from its historic intellectual darkness. To hold a responsible position in an underdeveloped country is to know that in the end everything depends on the education of the masses, on the raising of the level of thought, and on what we are too quick to call political teaching. In fact, we often believed with criminal superficiality that to educate the masses politically is to deliver a long political harangue from time to time. We think that it is enough that the leader or one of his lieutenants should speak in a pompous tone about the principal events of the day, for them to have fulfilled this bounden duty to educate the masses politically. Now, political education means opening their minds, awakening them, and allowing the birth of their intelligence. As Saussure said, it is, quote, to invent souls. To educate the masses politically does not mean, cannot mean, making a political speech. What it means is to try relentlessly and passionately to teach the masses that everything depends on them. That if we stagnate, it is their responsibility. And that if we go forward, it is due to them too. That there is no such thing as a demiurge. That there is no famous man who will take the responsibility for everything. But that the demiurge is the people themselves. And the magic hands are finally only the hands of the people. In order to put all this into practice, in order really to incarnate the people, we repeat that there must be decentralization in the extreme. The movement from the top to the bottom and from the bottom to the top should be a fixed principle, not through concern for formalism, but because simply to respect this principle is the guarantee of salvation. It is from the base that forces mount up, which supply the summit with this dynamic and make it possible dialectically for it to leap ahead. Once again, we Algerians have been quick to understand these facts, for no member of the government at the head of any recognized state has had the chance of availing himself of such a mission of salvation. For it is the rank and file who are fighting in Algeria, and the rank and file know well that without their daily struggle, hard and heroic as it is, the summit will collapse. And in the same way, those at the bottom know that without a head and without leadership, the base will split apart in incoherence and anarchy. The summit only draws its worth and its strength from the existence of the people at war. Literally, it is the people who freely create a summit for themselves, and not the summit that tolerates the people. The masses should know that the government and the party are at their service. A deserving people, in other words, a people conscious of its dignity, is a people that never forgets these facts. During the colonial occupation, the people were told that they must give their lives so that dignity might triumph. But the African peoples quickly came to understand that it was not only the occupying power that threatened their dignity. The African peoples were quick to realize that dignity and sovereignty were exact equivalents. And in fact, a free people living in dignity is a sovereign people. It is no use demonstrating that the African peoples are childish or weak. A government or a party gets the people it deserves. And sooner or later, a people gets the government it deserves. Practical experience in certain regions confirms this point of view. It sometimes happens at meetings that militants use sweeping, dogmatic formulas. The preference for this shortcut, in which spontaneity and oversimple sinking of differences dangerously combine to defeat intellectual elaboration, frequently triumphs. When we meet this shirking of responsibility in a militant, it is not enough to tell him he is wrong. We must make him ready for responsibility, encourage him to follow up his chain of reasoning, and make him realize the true nature, often shocking, inhuman, and in the long run sterile, of such oversimplification. Nobody, neither leader nor rank and filer, can hold back the truth. The search for truth in local attitudes is a collective affair. Some are richer in experience and elaborate their thought more rapidly, and in the past have been able to establish a greater number of mental links. But they ought to avoid riding roughshod over the people, for the success of the decision which is adopted depends upon the coordinated, conscious effort of the whole of the people. No one can get out of the situation scot-free. Everyone will be butchered or tortured, and in the framework of the independent nation, everyone will go hungry, and everyone will suffer in the slump. The collective struggle presupposes collective responsibility at the base and collegiate responsibility at the top. Yes, everybody will have to be compromised in the fight for the common good. No one has clean hands. There are no innocents and no onlookers. We all have dirty hands. We are all soiling them in the swamps of our country and in the terrifying emptiness of our brains. Every onlooker is either a coward or a traitor. The duty of those at the head of the movement is to have the masses behind them. Allegiance presupposes awareness and understanding of the mission, which has to be fulfilled. In short, an intellectual position, however embryonic. We must not voodoo the people, nor dissolve them in emotion and confusion. Only those underdeveloped countries, led by revolutionary elite who have come up from the people, can today allow the entry of the masses upon the scene of history. But we must repeat, it is absolutely necessary to oppose vigorously and definitively the birth of a national bourgeoisie and a privileged caste. To educate the masses politically is to make the totality of the nation a reality to each citizen. It is to make the history of the nation part of the personal experience of each of its citizens. As President Sékou Touré aptly remarked in his message to the Second Congress of African Writers. In the realm of thought, man may claim to be the brain of the world, but in real life, where every action affects spiritual and physical existence, the world is always the brain of mankind. For it is at this level that you will find the sum total of the powers and units of thought, and the dynamic forces of development and improvement, and it is there that energies are merged and the sum of man's intellectual values is finally added together. Individual experience, because it is national and because it is a link in the chain of national existence, ceases to be individual, limited and shrunken, and is enabled to open out into the truth of the nation and of the world. In the same way that during the period of armed struggle each fighter held the fortune of the nation in his hand, so during the period of national construction each citizen ought to continue in his real, everyday activity to associate himself with the whole of the nation, to incarnate the continuous dialectical truth of the nation, and to will the triumph of man in his completeness here and now. If the building of a bridge does not enrich the awareness of those who work on it, then that bridge ought not to be built, and the citizens can go on swimming across the river or going by boat. The bridge should not be, quote, parachuted down from above. It should not be imposed by a deus ex machina upon the social scene. On the contrary, it should come from the muscles and the brains of the citizens. Certainly, there may well be need of engineers and architects, sometimes completely foreign engineers and architects. But the local party leaders should be always present, so that the new techniques can make their way into the cerebral dessert of the citizen, so that the bridge in whole and in part can be taken up and conceived, and the responsibility for it assumed by the citizen. In this way, and in this way only, everything is possible. A government which calls itself a national government ought to take responsibility for the totality of the nation. And in an underdeveloped country, the young people represent one of the most important sectors. The level of consciousness of young people must be raised. They need enlightenment. If the work of explanation had been carried on among the youth of the nation, and if the Young People's National Union had carried out its task of integrating them into the nation, those mistakes would have been avoided, which have threatened or already undermined the future of the Latin American republics. The army is not always a school of war. More often, it is a school of civic and political education. The soldier of an adult nation is not a simple mercenary, but a citizen who by means of arms defends the nation. That is why it is of fundamental importance that the soldier should know that he is in the service of his country and not in the service of his commanding officer, however great that officer's prestige may be. We must take advantage of the national military and civil service in order to raise the level of the national consciousness and to detribalize and unite the nation. In an underdeveloped country, every effort is made to mobilize men and women as quickly as possible. It must guard against the danger of perpetuating the feudal tradition which holds sacred the superiority of the masculine element over the feminine. Women will have exactly the same place as men, not in the clauses of the Constitution, but in the life of every day, in the factory, at school, and in the parliament. If in the Western countries men are shut up in barracks, that is not to say that this is always the best procedure. Recruits need not necessarily be militarized. The national service may be civil or military, and in any case, it is advisable that every able-bodied citizen can at any moment take his place in a fighting unit for the defense of national and social liberties. It should be possible to carry out large-scale undertakings in the public interest by using recruited labor. This is a marvelous way of stirring up inert districts and of making known to a greater number of citizens the needs of their country. Care must be taken to avoid turning the army into an autonomous body which sooner or later, finding itself idle and without any definite mission, will, quote, go into politics and threaten the government. Drawing room generals, by dint of haunting the corridors of government departments, come to dream of manifestos. The only way to avoid this menace is to educate the army politically, in other words, to nationalize it. In the same way, another urgent task is to increase the militia. In case of war, it is the whole nation which fights and works. It should not include any professional soldiers, and the number of permanent officers should be reduced to a minimum. This is, in the first place, because officers are very often chosen from the university class, who would be much more useful elsewhere. An engineer is 1,000 times more indispensable to his country than an officer. And secondly, because the crystallization of the caste spirit must be avoided. We have seen in the preceding pages that nationalism, that magnificent song that made the people rise against their oppressors, stops short, falters, and dies away on the day that independence is proclaimed. Nationalism is not a political doctrine nor a program. If you really wish your country to avoid regression, or at best, halts and uncertainties, a rapid step must be taken from national consciousness to political and social consciousness. The nation does not exist in a program which has been worked out by revolutionary leaders and taken up with full understanding and enthusiasm by the masses. The nation's effort must be constantly adjusted into the general background of underdeveloped countries. The battle line against hunger, against ignorance, against poverty, and against unawareness ought to be ever present in the muscles and the intelligences of men and women. The work of the masses and their will to overcome the evils which have for centuries excluded them from the mental achievements of the past ought to be grafted onto the work and will of all underdeveloped peoples. On the level of underdeveloped humanity, there is a kind of collective effort, a sort of common destiny. The news which interests the Third World does not deal with King Baldwin, marriage, nor the scandals of the Italian ruling class. What we want to hear about are the experiments carried out by the Argentinians or the Burmese in their efforts to overcome illiteracy, or the dictatorial tendencies of their leaders. It is these things which strengthen us, teach us and increase our efficiency 10 times over. As we see it, a program is necessary for a government which really wants to free the people politically and socially. There must be an economic program. There must also be a doctrine concerning the division of wealth and social relations. In fact, there must be an idea of man and of the future of humanity. That is to say that no demagogic formula and no collusion with the former occupying power can take the place of a program. The new peoples, unawakened at first but soon becoming more and more clear-minded, will make strong demands for this program. The African people, and indeed all underdeveloped peoples, contrary to common belief, very quickly build up a social and political consciousness. What can be dangerous is when they reach the stage of social consciousness before the stage of nationalism. If this happens, we find in underdeveloped countries fierce demands for social justice, which paradoxically are allied with often primitive tribalism. The underdeveloped peoples behave like starving creatures. This means that the end is very near for those who are having a good time in Africa. Their government will not be able to prolong its own existence indefinitely. A bourgeoisie that provides nationalism alone as food for the masses fails in its mission and gets caught up in a whole series of mishaps. But if nationalism is not made explicit, if it is not enriched and deepened by a very rapid transformation into a consciousness of social and political needs, in other words, into humanism, it leads up a blind alley. The bourgeois leaders of underdeveloped countries imprison national consciousness in sterile formalism. It is only when men and women are included on a vast scale in enlightened and fruitful work that form and body are given to that consciousness. Then the flag and the palace where sits the government cease to be the symbols of the nation. The nation deserts these brightly lit, empty shells and takes shelter in the country, where it is given life and dynamic power. The living expression of the nation is the moving consciousness of the whole of the people. It is the coherent, enlightened action of men and women. The collective building up of a destiny is the assumption of responsibility on the historical scale. Otherwise, there is anarchy, repression, and the resurgence of tribal parties and federalism. The national government, if it wants to be national, ought to govern by the people and for the people, for the outcast and by the outcast. No leader, however valuable he may be, can substitute himself for the popular will. And the national government, before concerning itself about international prestige, ought first to give back their dignity to all citizens, fill their minds and feast their eyes with human things, and create a prospect that is human, because conscious and sovereign men dwell therein. On national culture, to take part in the African Revolution, it is not enough to write a revolutionary song. You must fashion the revolution with the people. And if you fashion it with the people, the songs will come by themselves and of themselves. In order to achieve real action, you must yourself be a living part of Africa and her thought. You must be an element of that popular energy which is entirely called forth for the freeing, the progress, and the happiness of Africa. There is no place outside that fight for the artist or for the intellectual who is not himself concerned with and completely at one with the people in the great battle of Africa and of suffering humanity. Sekou Touré. Each generation must, out of a relative obscurity, discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it. In underdeveloped countries, the preceding generations have both resisted the work or erosion carried by colonialism and also helped on the maturing of the struggles of today. We must rid ourselves of the habit, now that we are in the thick of the fight, of minimizing the action of our fathers, or of feigning incomprehension when considering their silence and passivity. They fought as well as they could, with the arms that they possessed then, and if the echoes of their struggle have not resounded in the international arena, we must realize that the reason for this silence lies less in their lack of heroism than in the fundamentally different international situation of our time. It needed more than one native to say, "We've had enough," more than one peasant rising crushed, more than one demonstration put down before we could today hold our own, certain in our victory. As for we who have decided to break the back of colonialism, our historic mission is to sanction all revolts, all desperate actions, all those abortive attempts drowned in rivers of blood. In this chapter, we shall analyze the problem, which is felt to be fundamental, of the legitimacy of the claims of a nation. It must be recognized that the political party which mobilizes the people hardly touches on this problem of legitimacy. The political parties start from living reality, and it is in the name of this reality, in the name of the stark facts which weigh down the present and future of men and women, that they fix their line of action. The political party may well speak in moving terms of the nation, but what it is concerned with is that the people who are listening understand the need to take part in the fight if, quite simply, they wish to continue to exist. Today, we know that in the first phase of the national struggle, colonialism tries to disarm national demands by putting forward economic doctrines. As soon as the first demands are set out, colonialism pretends to consider them, recognizing with ostentatious humility that the territory is suffering from serious underdevelopment, which necessitates a great economic and social effort. And in fact, it so happens that certain spectacular measures, centers of work for the unemployed which are opened here and there, for example, delay the crystallization of national consciousness for a few years. But sooner or later, colonialism sees that it is not within its powers to put into practice a project of economic and social reforms which will satisfy the aspirations of the colonized people. Even where food supplies are concerned, colonialism gives proof of its inherent incapability. The colonialist state quickly discovers that if it wishes to disarm the nationalist parties on strictly economic questions, then it will have to do in the colonies exactly what it has refused to do in its own country. It is not mere chance that almost everywhere today there flourishes the doctrine of Cartierism. The disillusioned bitterness we find in Cartier, when up against the obstinate determination of France to link to herself peoples which she must feed while so many French people live in want, shows up the impossible situation in which colonialism finds itself, when the colonial system is called upon to transform itself into an unselfish program of aid and assistance. It is why, once again, there is no use in wasting time repeating that hunger with dignity is preferable to bread eaten in slavery. On the contrary, we must become convinced that colonialism is incapable of procuring for the colonized peoples the material conditions which might make them forget their concern for dignity. Once colonialism has realized where its tactics of social reform are leading, we see it falling back on its old reflexes, reinforcing police effectives, bringing up troops, and setting a reign of terror which is better adapted to its interest and its psychology. Inside the political parties, and most often in offshoots from these parties, cultured individuals of the colonized race make their appearance. For these individuals, the demand for a national culture and the affirmation of the existence of such a culture represent a special battlefield. While the politicians situate their action in the actual present-day events, men of culture take their stand in the field of history. Confronted with a native intellectual who decides to make an aggressive response to the colonialist theory of pre-colonial barbarism, colonialism will react only slightly, and still less because the ideas developed by the young colonized intelligentsia are widely professed by specialists in their mother country. It is, in fact, a commonplace to state that for several decades, large numbers of research workers have, in the main, rehabilitated the African, Mexican, and Peruvian civilizations. The passion with which native intellectuals defend the existence of their national culture may be a source of amazement, but those who condemn this exaggerated passion are strangely apt to forget that their own psyche and their own selves are conveniently sheltered behind a French or German culture which has given full proof of its existence and which is uncontested.
Context of white supremacy. That will wrap us up for this week. We are beyond the halfway point in the book. Based on the pace that we've done thus far, I think we will have 3 sessions left after today. Today is 6, so I think, hoping, we can wrap this up in 3 sessions, and then we'll be able to move on to Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk, Neil Postman. Man, I'm super excited about that book. Anyway, Wretched of the Earth, Franz Fanon, if you have commentary you would like to share, the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to join us. Quickly, I think Mr. Demon 4, he said right when we were concluding the first audio segment, or excuse me, right when we, after we finished our discussion, after the first audio segment, he informed us that Dr. Marimba Ani in Yorugu, that at the beginning of chapter 5, she has a quote from Wretched of the Earth. I read it, and I said I was going to check to see where that is in the book once the next audio got started. That portion is from very early in the book, like the first 20-30 pages or so. I did not highlight what Dr. Marimba Ani highlighted, but almost that, I think it's exactly the sentence where she stopped highlighting, I started highlighting on the next sentence where it continued with what she was talking with the passage that she quoted where Fernand was talking about how they're the enemy of everything and all of that. I thought I did get a mild kick out of that, but yeah. Other folks, all the other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. Lines should be open. All the folks who dialed in from before, you should still be with us. Mr. Demery 4, Emmy, caller at 702, you all should all be with us. If other folks dialed in, if you have commentary you'd like to share, go ahead and get a hand up. We will get you on the line as well. No one has commentary?
Yes, ma'am, we heard.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I guess the part that I was talking about before was in the next reading. We're talking about the youth and the so-called fortifying the soul and developing the body to encouraging talent in sports. And, you know, they go on to talk about the athlete being conscious. But, you know, this book is reflecting, you know, it's a lot of, you know, high type words, but it doesn't show a clear understanding of what the system of white supremacy is all about. Not to me. I don't seem to be learning a whole lot. You know, it's not that he's saying here that actually hadn't been, you know, said before. But this part about the African people quickly realize that it is not only the occupier who threatens their dignity. You know, who else is threatening their dignity? You know, the other Africans? And the African people quickly realized that dignity and sovereignty were exact equivalents. In fact, a free people living in dignity is a sovereign people. A people living in dignity is a responsible people, and there is no point demonstrating that African people are infantile or retarded. You know, and I may be wrong, but what I gather from this is that there's no sense in going back over the fact that, you know, African people are backwards and infantile and unintelligent, stupid. I mean, he said, now he's using retarded in my version of the book. It may be different in the one that's being read. But just every opportunity to run down, you know, the underdeveloped countries or the non-white countries. And then over in another part, when he's talking about the government, the youth movement, you know, and the youth were going to be the army of tomorrow, this and that. And then he says that the army is never a school for war, but a school for civics, a school for politics. The soldier in a mature nation is not a mercenary, but a citizen who defends the nation by the use of arms. You know, this all sounds like a lot of propaganda. You know, it's the type of propaganda that you want to feed a 19 or 20-year-old person that's joining the army, you know, with the Marine commercials and how much dignity and respect you're going to get with this uniform. But in essence, you are going to be a mercenary, and you're going to be entering into other people's countries and stealing resources and victimizing other non-white individuals. So that part's not true. And then one last thing on the last chapter. Use a metaphor that it's better to go hungry with dignity than to eat one's fill in slavery. You know, how about just being able to have some dignity and then eat your fill also? How about that? And one last thing. That may have been it because I didn't really mark where we. Oh, the European researchers have widely rehabilitated African, Mexican, Peruvian civilization. Some have surprised by the passion invested by the colonized intellectuals in their defense of a national culture. You know, is that why the Europeans searched for years, decades, looking for some white lost civilization to back up their ideas about the Africans being infantile and they couldn't have had these advanced empires, the Maori, Ghana, and had these great kings and all this, you know, magnificent things that they contributed to society. That can't be true. It's got to be some white civilization somewhere. We'll just make up something, and then we'll hide these artifacts that we found that proves that the great Zimbabwe existed and all of that. We'll hide that. And, you know, those artifacts are really, a lot of artifacts are hidden to this day, you know, so that they can prove their so-called supremacy. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes, sir, Mr. Denry Four. Did any of the other folks who dialed in with a hand up have commentary that they wanted to share? Any of the other folks just spectating for the second half of the audio? Curses. Oh, retired firefighter, did you have commentary, sir?
Greetings. I tuned in on the almost the middle of the last reading for the day. And to me, it's more or less more of the same all through the book with the great Frantz Fanon. I might be wrong in saying it, incorrect in saying it, complicated. I would guess that he underestimated the global system of racism, white supremacy, being that, words in itself had not been used a whole lot in putting the brunt of the problems in Algeria as well as anywhere else on the planet Earth right at the feet of white people. Underestimated it. The whole context of suffering, people being mistreated. That's primarily in what he is describing all through the book, mistreatment, people being terrorized, people being deliberately denied the opportunity to educate themselves or to be educated. I can keep going on and on and on. It ends up coming back to the feet of people who identify themselves as white. There's some sort of romanticized thought that I have in the book that you can get something done and white people will still be able to, in the end, after you've accomplished all your goals, people still will be, in the end, be able to call themselves white at the end of all of this, you know, productivity that he is aspiring to. And if that's so, then it's not logical. It's not logical on what he's talking about. And not saying that he's not saying some things that are true, but I'm talking about the whole package in itself. If you do not put the focus on people who identify themselves as white, then you're probably not going to end up in a desirable place at the end of your research and or information book. And that's all I have to say for right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Glad to hear you are hanging tough down there in Florida. Other folks, any of the other folks that dialed in with a hand up, y'all have a commentary? If you dialed in and you have not shared, you think you have a comment that you want to make sure you get in, you should do so now. Did other folks have commentary?
right on. I will get my commentary and then check in again and see if anybody, anything stood out that they want to make sure they share. Let's see. I did take more notes in the second half, but that did not alter my opinion on the book. I just took a few more notes in the second half. It wasn't as wretched as the first portion. Let's see. The first one, Mr. Demery already pointed out the segment that he was anxious to read, was indeed in the second half of the audio, as I suspected. But I did think that that was an important tidbit about young people not wasting time at the stadiums, and that they, you know, we got real things that need to be done. He says a prime necessity in underdeveloped country functions in collaboration with the Ministry of Planning, which is another necessary institution in underdeveloped countries. The youth of Africa ought not to be sent to sports stadiums, but into the fields and into the schools. The stadium ought not to be a showplace erected in towns, but a bit of open ground in the midst of the fields that the young people must reclaim. Great, outstanding, but I mean, it would be reclaiming them from racist man and racist woman, and thus far, they have proven to be more powerful, and if they do not want to give up the stolen land or stolen people or any of the other things, people that they have stolen over the past number of centuries, then, you know, that's just what it is. Let's see. Also, let's see, when he says what it means to try relentlessly and passionately to teach the masses that everything depends on them, that if we stagnate, it is their responsibility, and if we go forward, it is due to them too, and that there is no such thing as a demurge, that there is no famous man who will take the responsibility for everything, but that the demurge is the people themselves, and the magic hands are finally only the hands of the people. In order to put all this into practice, in order to really incarnate the people, we repeat, there must be decentralization in the extreme. The decentralization, I remember this portion, I think Mel, who did the pleasures of reading Assata Shakur for us way back when, might be the one narrating Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk coming up soon. But when she was talking about four-wallism, and I connect that to everyone being a leader of one, where we're not looking for this black person to follow, to tell us what to do and when they're going to be giving the next talk, and something goes down, I got to wait to hear what they have to say. I got to call them up, or, you know, wait till they have a meeting or they're going to give a talk, so then I'll know, you know, what the position is that we're going to take after I hear them. Like, no, you have a brain computer. You can follow logic. You can come to your own conclusions about what needs to be done. And I agreed with that. I think a lot of what he's saying there in terms of learning, teaching, really being passionate about learning, because that's something that racists have deliberately deprived from us for so many centuries, so that we can be more powerful and higher functioning. Let's see. This is, I think, on 197. He says a government or a party gets the people it deserves, and sooner or later, a people gets the government it deserves. I'm not really sure what that means. That just sounds kind of like rhetoric to me. And in fact, I really kind of got the chills, because I've heard people say, we interviewed Paul Ifeoma Grant at the end of last year, and he was saying that black people in the States deserved to have President Donald Trump. People say that sort of thing in the system of white supremacy all the time. And it, to me, it kind of says that somehow black people are so messed up that you know, if this is the ragtag situation that you got yourself into, well, then you must be so shiftless and whatever else that this is what you deserve. I don't know if that's, you know, what was being conveyed there, but I mean, just anytime I hear that sort of statement in the context of racism, I really get suspicious, because I do not think any black person in the universe has done anything to deserve the conditions that we are currently in under white supremacy. Let's see. Next up, I did think this was important when he said, when we meet this shirking of responsibility in a militant, it is not enough to tell him he is wrong. And he was talking about people that combine to defeat intellectual elaboration with emotion. He was saying you must make them ready for responsibility, encourage him to follow up his chain of reasoning and make him realize the true nature, often shocking, inhuman, and order, and in the long run, sterile of such oversimplification. And again, this was, in my view, just talking about emotion. And he says it sometimes happens that in meetings that militants are using sweeping dogmatic formulas. The preference for this shortcut in which spontaneity and oversimple sinking of differences to short-circuit intellect. I thought that was important. I think there's still a lot of that. People just using a lot of jargons and rhetoric and slogans and emotion and yelling to get people to persuade people when they have not really laid out, you know, logic, a plan. That's why I caution people about those metaphors, because that can be a part of that emotional appeal sometimes. He also, when he says, nobody, neither leader nor rank and file, can hold back the truth. Very important. I think that's right, a part of following the logic. Let's see where he says. Just about learning. I think he had a lot in this portion about learning, even if you're having to learn from other people, quote unquote, foreigners, to learn so that information is no longer foreign to you. Great. I think no problem with us trying to learn as much as we can. I agree with Mr. Demery Ford's point about some of this sounding a little like propaganda to join the military. I was thinking that as well, like just the kind of rhetoric of it all. I can kind of agree with that. Thought it was great, particularly the regular attacks against black male privilege that he writes in an underdeveloped country. Every effort is made to mobilize men and women as quickly as possible. It must guard against the danger of perpetuating the feudal tradition which holds sacred the superiority of the masculine element over the feminine. Women will have exactly the same place as men, not in the clauses of the Constitution, but in the life of every day, in the factory, at school, and in the parliament. If in the Western countries men are shut up in barracks, that is not to say that this is always the best procedure. Again, great notion, counter to the black male privilege notion. Let's see. Yeah, this, when I say it, to me, it sounded like a lot of rhetoric. This paragraph, this is the end of 204, before the segment on national culture, where he says the national government, if it wants to be national, ought to govern by the people and for the people, for the outcast and by the outcast. No leader, however valuable he may be, can substitute himself for the popular will. It just sounds really rhetoric-y, and a lot of the rhetorical ethic that whites spout about the different systems of government that they've set up around the world, that most of the time just cloak the system of white supremacy, which is the government on the planet right now. So the next session on national culture, this is the sentence. This is the line from Wretched of the Earth that everybody quotes. Each generation must, out of relative obscurity, discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it. And people say like that, like that's the deepest thing ever. Like, oh, wow. Can you believe I remember that from Fanon? If that's the heaviest line from this book, or if that's the most constructive thing that people got, they could have put that in a quote book. And, you know, we could have just all skipped having to sift through, you know, all of this writing. But there it is, all the way out in this Czech segment. Let's see. This really cooked my grits towards the end of the last portion of what we read. And people do this on a regular basis as well. When they talk about racism, white supremacy, they do not connect it to individual white people. They do not connect it to individual white people. This happens on a regular basis. Racism, white supremacy will be acknowledged, but talked about as though it is a thing, as though it's customs, procedures, just it happens that way because, you know, we're just kind of all bumbling along and stumbling along and keeping things going. And all the racists were here before and they just set all this up. And now we're just kind of following around blindly because we don't know what's happening and all of that. where he says, as soon as the first demands are set out, colonialism, not white people, pretends to consider them, recognizing with ostentatious humility that the territory is suffering from serious underdevelopment, which necessitates a great economic and social effort. And in fact, it so happens that certain spectacular measures, centers for work for the unemployed, which are opened here and there, for example, delay the crystallization of national consciousness for a few years, but sooner or later, colonialism, not white people, sees that it is not within its power to put into practice a project of economic and social reforms which will satisfy the aspirations of the colonized people. I'll stop right there. Just, I think it's very, very important, even if we're not, you know, we being victims of racism, black people, even if we're not always able to publicly say, right, that we're talking about racist man, racist woman. We're talking about white people being the problem. Even if we're not always able to say it, that's the way that we should understand what this is. And I've just found that consistently we shy away from that. We don't want to talk about it in that way. And that is to our detriment when we try to position this problem as just something nebulous and not as the, this is the direct and deliberate behavior of racist man and racist woman that is perpetuating all of these difficulties, all of this wretchedness on the planet. That's just telling the truth. And I think that's how you get problems solved, being truthful, accurate, in outlining exactly the nature of the problem. Did anybody else have commentary they wanted to make sure they share? If you have a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello? Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. For the remain, well, not necessarily that'll be the only thing I'm focusing on, but I'm to wonder, I know within most of us, if not all of us, there's a certain degree of like self-hate or something like that, but I'm beginning to really question to the degree that Mr. Fanon might be experiencing it. I'm trying to back off just a little bit and critiquing just because I'm just ready to be like VGQ, he said what he said, just because I don't want to be negative, I suppose. But I am curious, maybe in his other texts, which I don't think I would read to find out just to know that, but I wonder, because I don't get the impression just listening, the tone of the text doesn't hold non-white people in a high esteem at all. It sounds very much to me like a very rough critique that doesn't offer any constructive or viable solutions. And that could just be me. And so I'm not, again, very clear as to what his intention is in writing the book. I never knew before, because I had never read the text before. And then when we went through the introduction, I was like, okay, maybe I understand a little bit. But now I'm not so sure what his intention is, because it doesn't guide the reader in a clear direction. It does not provide any relations or very clear analysis that could be constructive. And it seems to lead the reader in a very circular pattern, like it's just continuous going around in the same thing and just pointing out things. So it's like a book of observations or something like that. And it just does not seem to say, well, within these people, there's the potential for this, or we could move in this direction or anything like that for me, the way that I've interpreted it and heard it. But I'm really wondering why he wrote it. And I don't even think he outlines why he wrote it, like I mentioned, and this is why I'm writing this, so that this can happen. So that's just something that is sticking out to me. Thank you.
Interesting. I can say for myself, having read Black Skin, White Mask more than once, and having read it the second time around where I was a little more informed about racism, and I knew at that point that he was married to a white person and that, you know, was a no-no under counter-racist code. And that time I went through read it and took extensive notes to share that I knew going in that I was taking these notes to share with others. And at least my perception would be absolutely that book has the same type of condescending and contempt, condescension and contempt for other victims of racism, black people specifically. And since most of that book is focused on sexual intercourse, it seems to be a lot of contempt and kind of really rough criticism, as you said, crude criticism of black people who are sexually involved with white people or aspiring to be sexually involved with white people. And it was all the more galling for me because he was so aggressive in his rebukes, and he himself is married to a white woman, unless I have been misinformed. The other folks have commentary they wanted to get in last 10 minutes or so. If you have commentary, if you have not spoken, you should definitely speak now. Do we miss anybody?
Can I say one last thing? Yes.
For sure.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I wanted to say, he talked briefly about black market, how the store owners would have to report to a commissioner, and he would set the prices, and he would tell him how much he could sell it for, and all of this type of thing. So and then it developed into a black market. And then the black market, I've been in a country where the black market was, you know, it could be, you know, in the millions and possibly billions of dollars of black market. And, you know, if you can't get something legally and somebody can provide it for you, even if it's illegal or outside the normal economy, then if there's a demand for it, then the supply would be there. So, but it just, even when a country gets its independence, that the colonizer or the whites, European whites, can still put those tariffs on you, and they can just not, you know, sanctions and all of this, just not do business with you. And that'll doom your country, you know, by itself. And then you have all this black market going on, and then crime increased. Now, so you sort of self-destruct anyway, and then it still goes back to the usual suspects, and those are those that are in charge of white supremacy. I'll mute my line. Thanks, God.
Indeed. I thought that whole section where he was talking about the black market and how all that developed, I think the reason that all that developed to begin with was because the people in charge decided that, oh, the niggers, we are not going to allow you free access to roam and go wherever you want to, so you can buy your goodies and go to whichever market. They decided that, no, we're going to restrict your mobility in terms of where you can go, which meant that, you know, everybody had a tougher time getting things from the market, which, again, all of these problems go back to racist man, racist woman, directly or indirectly. Anybody else have any other commentary they want to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just forgot to mention earlier, I did find that post that I was talking about, and it wasn't a revolutionary starter kit. It's, I think a woman has started like a candle business, and perhaps she must include books or something like that. Or maybe she was just taking a picture. It was vague. Like, I tried to look more into what she was really selling. But I think her primary thing is like candles, and maybe she throws in a book. And she had two of Fanon's books. So when she took the picture, it was like, this is the kit that she was sending out. But that's it.
I see. It's like, wow, they got revolutionary starter kits. I was so intrigued. Like, what do they have in there? Like dashiki, or what exactly do you get? A red, black, and green flag, or who knows?
Actually, yes, you do get that. She does have those.
Wow.
You do get your RGB flag.
Well, I guess that's all you need. You halfway got Whitey licked. Your RGB flag and Fanon, hey, that is half the battle. Anything else folks needed to get in? I will assume folks are satisfied. I think we have 3 sessions left. I'll have to double check on that, but I think it should be about 3 before we are all done. Franz Fanon, the wretched of the earth. If you are listening to the archives, you can feel free to drop an email and you can read your commentary online, not on the air. We'll have more sessions to come. If you wrote commentary in over the last few weeks, then I'll have to dig back through my email and catch up and see if folks shared anything. If so, we'll read those over the next few weeks that we until we get to the conclusion of the text. Again, for people that were searching for part 3 of Wretched of the Earth, it has been uploaded. It is in iTunes, so you should be able to download it. It's at Black Talk Radio Network as well, so feel free to go back if you need that section to review. It is available, and double-checking if any of the other sections are missing from the past couple of weeks since I was down and out. I will go back, review, and make sure that those are posted as well. If folks have questions, difficulties, gripes, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, we'll be here next or tomorrow. Compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll also be here on Sunday, Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Looking forward to hearing from folks worldwide. Get their thoughts as the end of the summer wraps up. With that, thanks again to everybody for tuning in. Book Club should be back. Normal schedule now that I'm feeling way better. Thanks, everyone, for their patience. I will again encourage, strongly recommend Sobriety Would Be Best Under Conditions of White Supremacy. Last few days of the bright sunny days, enjoy it while it's here. But I would encourage, if you're going to be out and about, going to the beach or anything else, do it sober. You do not want to have your fun time interrupted by some race soldier, badge or no, where you all of a sudden might have to make phenomenal decisions, life-saving decisions, and have your judgment impaired because you had a few to drink or anything else, any other narcotics, drugs that racists offer on the planet. Sobriety would be best. And buckle up if you're going to be in the vehicle. Make sure I get those reminders in as well. Anything that we can do to minimize contact with enforcement officials, that means being sober if you're behind the wheel. That means definitely buckle up if you are a driver, passenger, even if you are a pedestrian. You still want to be sober. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.